Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
It's me, exhausted, happy, just made a trip back and forth to San Francisco to do a deposition. They wouldn't do it on video, they wouldn't come here, and that by law they could make me go there just to harass the attorney. And I won't tell you about that case, but I have a wonderful announcement to make and to give you a little detail on. It's one of the most important courtroom events that I've been involved in. A jury has given an $11.9 million award, almost $12 million, in what is essentially a Paxil suicide case. And the case is important in a number of ways. First of all, it was a federal case. It was in the U.S. District Court of Pennsylvania, in the Middle District in Scranton. It happened on September 15. And that's not an area of big awards. It's an area that, you know, was cautious about these matters. The case involved a man named Barbarose. Mr. Barbarose had been put in jail. Why he got in jail was not an issue in the case, but I believe it was actually Paxil-related. He hadn't harmed anybody. And they didn't manage to get him the Paxil he was taking, Paxil 30 milligrams, or his trazodone, 100 milligrams at night. And they botched that. And then after 4 days in jail, they finally called their psychiatrist. The suit was not against the jail. It's against the healthcare provider. They finally called the healthcare provider's psychiatrist, who ordered 30 milligrams of Paxil. He didn't ask the man's name. He didn't ask the man's age. He didn't ask if the man had been in jail for a while. Didn't ask if the man had been off his Paxil for a while, when in fact he'd been off it for at least 4 days, because that's how long he'd been in the jail. And by then, it's down to a negligible amount in his body. So he ordered him his trazodone, and he got that at night. And then the next morning, he got his Paxil. He was then seen by a psychologist, whom I also testified against, about three or four hours after the Paxil. And he was already depressed for the first time since he'd been in jail. He was handling being in jail rather well, communicated well, related to people. There were no signs of suicide whatsoever. And they actually did some suicide evaluations. And now we're a few hours after he's taken Paxil, and he's crashing. I was able to go back in the history, much to the dismay of the defense, and find out that he had also gotten very distressed when he started Paxil at just 10 milligrams. And then they'd put him on trazodone, they'd put him on benzodiazepines to get him through it, through the 10 milligram agitation. So I was able to show, look, this is what happened early on. So they gave him the 30 milligrams. The psychologist interviewed him and said he looked like a cornered rat, that he was scared. He was practically monosyllabic. All this is new after starting the Paxil, that he was withdrawn. And he didn't report this. He didn't look at past records of the psychologist. He didn't report to anybody how bad off the man was. He just made some notes, and that was the end of it. I called it callous indifference, which added considerably to the amount of the award. Then that night at bedtime, they failed to give him his trazodone. And I think that was somewhat a contributor, because the trazodone apparently for him did act as a sedative and calm him down. There was no monitoring done. And that night, the man killed himself in a most horrific fashion that I won't describe in detail. But violent suicides are typical of the antidepressants. Essentially, the man gagged himself to death, which was just a terrible thing. The jail was not at fault. They weren't told to monitor. They weren't told to pay special attention to him. So the fault lay in a whole series of events leading up to his not getting his medication until he got it after he'd essentially been withdrawn from it. He was in a state of withdrawal. Then on top of it, he's given the large dose, so he's got two different kinds of interactions going on in his body. And there were signs of akathisia. Even though he was in the cell, he could be seen coming and going more often to the window. He was seen pacing in the cell, which is a telltale sign of akathisia. And also he showed other signs of behaving differently, and in fact was described as behaving bizarrely by the one of the jail attendants, all after the initiation of the Paxil. And he killed himself somewhere around late evening or early morning of that day. So he'd been many hours on the Paxil, but not a full cycle of a day. Akathisia is a horrible experience. I was able to document this for the jury and to show them that this was a common occurrence, and that it was even written up in the old DSM-4, the 2000, as potentially leading to suicide and violence, and worsening of the condition and psychosis. And also in the DSM, it said that the SSRIs also cause it. But I had lots of other data, all kinds of data that I had as a background to the case. Again, $11.9 million for what was essentially, but not entirely, a Paxil suicide case. Now, this case has been reported widely, you know, with a few paragraphs on Fox website and on the ABC website, and reported in some of the local newspapers. Nowhere is my testimony that this was a Paxil case reported. I'm linking to one legal report which at least mentions a Paxil, but it acts like it was some failure to give it in a timely manner. That is, as if he needed the Paxil rather than it was the Paxil itself that caused the suicide as the primary cause of the suicide. It's like there's an invisible hand out there, and it's the drug company cleansing everything that happens in the media. So I've just gotten back. I've been really rushed. And Bob Fultz, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
I haven't even prepared an intro for you. It's been so hectic on getting back. But let me tell the audience that I've known Bob since he was a very young man, which means I've gotten on in years to know anybody who's a very young man. And Bob has always been my example of just a stellar psychologist. He has a PsyD. He teaches at the Chicago School of Psychology. Is that the proper name?
Yeah, it's the Chicago School of Professional Psychology.
The Professional Psychology. Bob is a kind and gentle and thoughtful and intelligent man. He is, I'm sure, a good clinician. He was one of the early psychologists to dare associate closely with me, and that was, again, that's a while back, and I've always been grateful for that. And on top of it all, he's a great teacher, and beyond that, he's a researcher. He's actually a genuine researcher. So, Robert, hello.
Hello, how are you? You know, and with that description, it made me think the first time you and I met was during the release of your first brain disabling treatments in psychiatry book. So was that like 97? Is that when that
book
came out?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's right.
Cuz you were doing
it was.
Yeah, you were doing a book fair here in Chicago, and that's how we crossed paths.
Wow.
So
that's
a long time ago. Yeah.
You had already formed a lot of your concepts then.
Well,
that
you know
were
what
critical
happened?
Of the medications.
Yeah, you know what happened? I, as a graduate student, so I was still in grad school at the time, and I was part of a group that was interested in doing psychotherapy with people diagnosed with schizophrenia. So it was a group of graduate students and psychologists and psychiatrists from around the Chicago area, and hearing that you were coming in, that's the group that you came and spoke to for us. But when I was a graduate student, I was also working in hospitals quite a bit, and I was always very interested in the patient's experience of care, and I kept hearing, you know, I was working with adults primarily diagnosed with schizophrenia, and I kept having discussions with these people, and they were telling me that they didn't necessarily feel better on their medications. So in my graduate courses, I would push back on this idea. We were constantly being told that, you know, all of these things are brain disorders and they're genetic and it's a chemical imbalance. And as I pushed back, I had a professor call me into his office, and I thought, oh boy, I'm in big trouble. And he slid a book across his desk and said, you may want to read this. And it was your book, Toxic Psychiatry. And it flipped everything upside down. Everything that I was being taught, I was just like, wait a second, and had to deeply reconsider this stuff. So that was back in the mid-90s that I read that book, and then you and I met in 97. So yeah, it's been a long time.
That's great. And you've been having a great career. I mean, you're well established where you are, despite your views or because of your views.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit because of my views. My private practice, so in addition to teaching and doing some research, I have a part-time private practice. And I would say, for the most part, these are people that have kind of been through the system and it hasn't treated them particularly well. And they'll hear rumor that I'm willing to work with somebody that's not on medications. And that makes up a good portion of my clients. I also see a lot of teenagers who are at the front end of getting involved in the system. So I work pretty hard at keeping people informed about what their options are.
That's great. You know, and that's happened to me too. I have so many people who come to see me who have been through the psychiatric mill. And they're so grateful just to see a cheery face and somebody who's, you know, showing some interest in the patient's viewpoint.
Yeah, yeah. And then they have to work through that kind of staggering realization that a lot of what they've been told isn't necessarily based in hard science. And the evidence base for a lot of what we call evidence-based is not really there.
Yeah.
So it's a scary system. Scary process.
Very, 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 very much so. Well, you've been very brave about it. I don't know that I've asked you in recent years. Have you gotten much blowback? Have you gotten much aggravation for what you've been doing?
I get some. So I do a fair amount of public speaking on medication issues. And, you know, I always really try to appreciate the fact that there are, without a doubt, people that in their experience have felt benefits from being on medications. And I never try to challenge that, because those people are out there. But I think at a population level across the country, I think people are often put on, this even applies to certain psychotherapy strategies, but they are told to engage in a certain treatment, and they're not getting the results that they're told they should get. And that makes them feel further damaged. So in terms of the blowback, I haven't gotten too much. I try to be pretty disarming in my approach. But then once you start presenting the data, it's hard for people to really refute it. There is that kind of that cognitive dissonance of, wait a second, this isn't what I've been told for the last 20 years. But working through that and kind of in a painstaking way, breaking down the evidence for them, I get a lot of, actually it ends up being a lot of support. I do get some people that say, you know, I'm full of it, I'm nuts. But for the most part, I get a lot of like, wow, I wish I would have known this a long time ago.
Well, that's great. It sounds like you have been able to really live to tell the tale and to enjoy life while being a reformer. This is a good message for the folks. I mean, you're a happy man. I mean, anyone can tell that. And and yet you have taken these big risks and not bought into the system and sold out. So first, I applaud you for it. And second, I just think you're a shining example to other psychologists.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, and one of the other vehicles that I've tried to use throughout these years is create opportunities to really give a voice to the people going through this treatment. So it just made me think that for my dissertation, I interviewed 45 adults that were currently hospitalized in a state psychiatric hospital. They were all had the diagnosis of schizophrenia, but the entire goal of the dissertation was to do a qualitative survey of if they felt the medications were helpful, or even just, it was entitled The Experience of Being Medicated. So it was just their experience of being on medications. And I really wanted to create an opportunity for them to share their experiences. And then even more recently, and to that point, just regarding my dissertation, your concept of deactivation hit it perfectly. Only one of the people I interviewed said that their auditory hallucinations disappeared. Many of their responses included that the message changed, the intensity changed, the frequency changed, but all of them continued to be bothered and persistently bothered by the voices that they were hearing. So that's one example, but they reacted to it less, which made them made the people around them more able to tolerate being around them, which it really captures that idea of deactivation. You know, it suppressed their reaction to the terror that they were continuing to experience. So that set things in motion for me. It really kind of confirmed what I had been reading in toxic psychiatry and the other literature. So more recently, I did a survey of adolescents that were placed in residential treatment centers. And I'm actually somebody, prior to teaching, I worked in residential treatment centers for about 15 years. And even though it is often a target of criticism, I have seen countless kids benefit from being in residential care. But it's also an environment where kids are put on many medications, so the issue of polypharmacy is definitely a concern. But recently I did a study exploring their experience of being in care, and medications was one of the topics that we pursued in that. And sure enough, I think it was just over half the kids, or about 57% of the kids, had negative things to say about being on medications, whereas almost three-quarters of the kids had positive things to say about being in therapy. So it's an ongoing issue that I'm pursuing, and part of that is giving voice to the people that are in the midst of experiencing it.
You know, I read your dissertation. It was really good. Excuse me. Traveling, catching up to me a little, and I'm always afraid to hit my mute button for fear I'll disappear from the face of the earth.
It'll be just me talking.
Oh my God. Well, that would be fine. You could handle it,
but
you need a signal. You need a signal to just keep talking. I've seen your dissertation. I've read it. I actually cited it. Did you ever publish that? I'm not aware of it in any separate form.
It did. It ended up as a chapter in one of the International Society for the Psychological Treatment of Schizophrenia books. It was in their edition called Beyond Medications. And this was years ago. It was probably in, 2005 or 6, something like that. In fact, one of the psychiatrists that was present when you came to Chicago to speak back when we first met, his name's David Garfield, and he's trained as a psychiatrist, but also has written a couple books about the treatment of schizophrenia through psychotherapy. His book is called Unbearable Affect, and he was the lead author on that book that my chapter appeared in.
How interesting. Would you send me a PDF of it? Can you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, I sure will.
Because I think I have a place for it in the book I'm working on right now.
Oh, great. Yep, I definitely will.
Good, 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 good. Gee, it's nice to be back in touch with you. You're one of the folks in my life that I just wish was more there. And, you know, Ginger and I, we are so busy. And me being a guy, you know, I don't have that the tendency necessarily of Ginger to reach out to people outside of what we're doing right in front of our noses. But all my relationships seem to be led by, what am I working on right now?
Exactly, exactly.
But it's so good just to hear your voice. I mean, it's just very, very nice. The work you've been doing is so good. I mean, that was such a great thing to do, to actually go and start asking people what their experience was. You know, I got started working at 18 in a state mental hospital, and that's what I did.
Yep.
You know, I just talked to people about their experience.
Yeah, and I was really shocked to find out that very few surveys had ever been done like the one I had. In fact, here was a little pushback. I'll just tell this story quickly. When I was
Take your time.
When I was finishing, it was actually at my internship, and I was going to be interviewing the patients that were hospitalized there, and so I had to go through the state of Illinois' institutional review board. And when I tell my students this story because many of them are in their dissertation process, but I thought, you know, this is an ambitious little project I wanted to do. A lot of my fellow students were doing advanced literature searches, but I was going to go do some applied research. And so I had to go meet with the institutional review board. And it was this big room I walked into, and as a graduate student, it was incredibly intimidating. And I sat down next to the head of the table. So I sat down next to the chairperson of the institutional review board. And he says, well, I'd like to start today's meeting, and we'll discuss Bob Fultz's dissertation project or his proposal. And I'd like to start by saying that if he runs this program, he'll never work in the field again. And there was just this like hush that fell over the room. And I was sitting there completely stunned. I thought they would just kind of pat me on my head and send me on my way and said, you know, go make the world a better place. But he said, if I run my research project, I'll never work in the field again. And the guy next to me, I'm not sure if he was a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but he leaned over and said under his breath, you're going to make psychiatrists look like idiots. And my original plan was to give the people that were hospitalized a survey about their experience of being on medications and then give their prescribing psychiatrist a paralleling survey and find out where the agreement was or where there was disagreement, to, you know, compared to if the psychiatrist is supposed to understand their response to medications, how congruent is their impression? So I had to completely rework my schedule or my research methodology, and it became so I was able to keep my survey with the people that were hospitalized, but I had to use a standardized form. It's not used that much anymore. It's called the Brief Psychiatric Rating Scale. So in that way, I was able to monitor the doctor's response, or at least their impression of medication response in the client, and then compared that to the patient's response. But it was
that scale something that was they filled out just for the study, or did you pull it out of their records?
I pulled it out of their records. It was one of the forms that was just by default they had to fill out as part of the state system. So I figured, you know what, it's in everybody's file. At least it'll be completed. And it's one that the institutional review board can't push back and say that, you know, I can't make these doctors spend their time filling out another survey or something.
That's interesting. I had a little bit of a parallel idea about a journal. At the time, I had some extremely – I won't mention his name now. He's gone. But extremely well-known humanistic psychologist who was on my advisory council at the time, going way back. And we were talking about starting a new humanistic psychology type of journal – one that would really take on the issues, unlike most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat around for an evening, about seven or eight of us, to plan the journal. And I made a suggestion that any case studies that were published by a clinician should be also shown to the subject, who would have a chance to respond and present his or her own opinion on their own case.
And that's a great idea.
This would be a standard for this amazing new journal. I got a violently angry response from this humanistic psychologist.
Wow, that's surprising. You would think that they'd be totally in support of that.
Well, I was actually shocked, but now nothing shocks me.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, if you're well known in the field, how'd you get that way?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a very few of us have gotten that way by standing up for truth. We've done something along the way to compromise that's made us acceptable to the institutions or whatever.
Yeah.
But you've really lived a very honorable life as a psychologist, and it's a tribute to your school, too.
Yeah, yep. You know, that is, so I've been teaching at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology since 2009, and I haven't worked in an environment that is so so open to challenging the current zeitgeist out there or the current paradigms. You know, we're very much about examining evidence-based approaches, and we're one of the few schools that continue to make students at least get exposure to psychodynamic theory and existential humanistic and systems theory and cognitive behavioral, and the students across the board get exposure to those different frameworks. But I actually get to teach a course called a Seminar in Pediatric Psychopharmacology. And in that course, you know, everyone, all the faculty know my views of medications, but in that course, we just go step by step and critically examine some of the biggest and most robust studies that would seem to support the use of medications in youth. But what we do is really just tear back all the, you know, the veils of statistics and everything and say, wait a second, what are these outcomes really showing us? And so many times I'll have students leave that course really rethinking this perfunctory use of medications that we have. You know, the fact that the United States uses over 80% of the world's Ritalin supply really has to be wondered about. And it'd be one thing if we were getting great results through the use of Ritalin, but we aren't. And the MTA study, which is this big landmark study that was done years ago, and they continue to follow these kids, this study continues to show that the kids that were receiving Ritalin are not doing any better than the ones that just received behavior modification. In fact, the behavior modification arm continued to improve even though the treatment had stopped. So it's those kind of conclusions that you walk away and you read all the propaganda and you think, oh, medications are the way to go. But really being informed about the science out there is giving the students a new perspective. So I'm really grateful for having the opportunity to teach. You know, we're APA accredited, so we have to teach within the APA expectations. But even beyond that, we get flexibility to really kind of push the envelope and help these students become competent, ethical psychologists.
That's wonderful work you're doing. It's just absolutely wonderful. Didn't in the MTA study, one of the quote behavioral things was a few weeks at a summer camp? Didn't that come out as well or better than the drugs?
Yeah, and in fact, one of the principal investigators, William Pelham, who I just encountered at a conference at NYU several weeks ago, So he was one of the lead researchers or one of the principal investigators in the MTA study, and he was one of the researchers that started to push back against this kind of obligatory use of medications because he said, wait a second, we didn't necessarily show that Ritalin was getting the best response. And since that time, he has created these summer camp programs largely based on the methods that were used in the MTA study because you're right, those programs were getting really good results, and they were just brief programs that created structure and some behavior modification principles and non-medication approaches for kids. So yeah, those programs are definitely out there now.
it's so good that you're there. So good you're doing all this. You've been doing research of your own and lots of other things. Do you want to shift in that direction, more about your research?
Yep. And actually, just on the heels of that, the comments you made about the case you just returned from, one of the issues, and this isn't related to my research, but just a quick question, because it's a topic that I've heard about and I just don't know that much about, is some sort of metabolic test for SSRIs. Is that something that is an established piece of the science to determine who is going to, at least the odds are increased that they're going to respond favorably to SSRIs, or is that still part of the propaganda that I've just fallen victim to? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I think what you're talking about has been garbled and passing it on to you.
Okay.
What is very well documented is that some people do not aren't what's called a good metabolizer of SSRIs. They don't have the genetic endowment in the form of liver enzymes that enables them to break it down and destroy it as easily as some others might. So that if you give them 10 milligrams of a drug, it might be a 20 or 30 milligram effect.
Wow.
And a friend of mine in Australia, blocking on her name right now, has actually published some papers on this. They can be Googled simply enough by just Googling violence and genetics, SSRIs,
okay,
and enzymes. She has evidence that a number of the homicides in Australia were committed by people who were poor metabolizers. That's the code word. Poor metabolizers of the drug. And that test is readily available. It's fairly expensive, but if the drug companies were honorable and wanted to make it available so we could see who was going to react worse, not who would do better.
Right, right.
We don't have, since nobody does better on SSRIs, there's no test to tell who would do better. I mean, the studies don't show, the real good mm-hmm. studies that we've talked about on this show before, you know, they show that SSRIs are no better than placebo and
right.
a lot worse because of their adverse effects. But what they do alert you to is a more likelihood of a toxic reaction because of, and that toxic reaction could be physical, be a serotonin syndrome, or it could be more mental, like violence and suicide and depression and anxiety and so on.
Wow.
That we could avert some of the worst reactions from overdose, essentially, by testing everybody before they took an SSRI. Now, in that case, these tests would come way down in cost because there'd be, you know, millions of them being performed. They'd find a way to do them real cheap, I'm sure. So the drug companies have avoided that, and I think someday they should be sued for that, for failing to make that readily available as a part of a requirement in association with anybody taking the drug. It should be a requirement.
Yeah, because the risk seems tremendous. And that does speak to one of the areas of research. I mean, there are just so many different tentacles of this, because one of the things I was going to talk about today was the research around the youth that I interviewed and my students and I interviewed in residential treatment. But just talking about the SSRIs, not too many months ago, it was just sometime over the summer, The Lancet published a meta-analytic review of antidepressants and their use in young people. And just to confirm that, or to reiterate the point that you just made, they are finding, or they just reanalyze the data to demonstrate that the use of antidepressants in youth is no better than a placebo. But in this sample of kids that we interviewed in their residential treatment center, there were dozens of kids on antidepressants. It was one of the more popular classes of medications that these kids were on. And it so that piece, then wondering about this test that could be available for them, because one of the primary reasons for residential referral or referring a kid to residential care is agitated and aggressive behavior. So it's these kids that are unable to be managed in the home, that usually have been through the system for many months, if not several years, before they're placed in residential care. But what that means is that they are, you know, in and out of treatment, in and out of the hospital, which means more medications, and they just end up going down this spiral. But if there was some way to determine who was going to end up becoming aggressive as a result of the SSRI exposure, that would be a huge advantage for these kids.
Yeah, really? And it wouldn't be that specific. What the test would show would be that you've got a greater likelihood of all the worst things happening to you that can happen from SSRIs.
Yeah.
Including a life-threatening serotonin syndrome, you know, where you get feverish and your muscles start getting hyperactive, you know, and it's a very, very profound threat, even affects the brain function and mental processes. Yeah, wow. It would be very important to use that as a screening tool so that they would get lower doses or no doses at all,
right?
Depending on the ethics of whoever was involved with giving it. By the way, folks, the radio show where we talked at length about the adult studies on SSRIs was with Irving Kirsch, who's written books and articles about it. And it was on June 8th. And I should say this almost every show. I now have up on my website, which is a newly redone site. Much of the content's the same, but it's completely with a whole new operating system, and it's just much better and looks a little more up to date. I have on there the radio shows so that they can be searched, so that you can go and just search Irving Kirsch. But it is June 8th that show took place.
Oh, that's great.
I imagine you've met Irving, haven't you?
I haven't met him, but I read his book, The Emperor's New Drugs. And in fact, a documentary that you were recently on, or a documentary that was recently released that you were on, Letters from Generation RX, he's highlighted on that as well. He's really produced some important data. It's really fascinating.
And the director and producer of Generation RX is Kevin Miller. And Kevin's also been a few times on the radio show. So, again, this is so nice now. I can just tell people, go to my website, look up the radio show, and you can search it, which you couldn't otherwise
awesome.
Do online. And that's my wonderful Ian, who is my assistant. Helps me in a lot of ways to set that up, and it works really good.
Awesome. That's great.
So tell us more about the research with the kids.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm starting to look at more closely and trying to develop a paper to publish is the issue of the polypharmacy. So one of the trends that I've seen in these kids, we interviewed almost 100 kids across 7 different residential centers. And one of the things that came up, and I've only found, is it one, maybe two, but definitely one paper in the literature about this. It's called The Dopamine Dilemma. And so these kids that are showing up in my data set are on medications that are working against each other. And the example is, you know, antipsychotics are used so often in these troubled kids. And when those are paired with stimulants, the way those medications work, and you'll know far better about this than I do, but, you know, the antipsychotics, their mechanism of action or how they're thought to work chemically is through blocking dopamine and blocking serotonin. And it does vary, you know, the receptor sites that they zero in on varies a little bit between the different antipsychotics, but the overall impact is similar. You know, they're shutting down the transmission of dopamine. But then the use of stimulants, during the use of antipsychotics, stimulants work by dramatically boosting dopamine transmission. So it begins to, I'm trying to figure this out with these kids of, you know, like, are they on typical doses? Because if they're on typical doses, I don't know how the prescribers could expect to get any positive results, because the meds are working against each other. And then the combined effects of side effects and, you know, the feeling of failed treatment for these poor kids, It's a real big dilemma that is in about a quarter, a little over a quarter of the kids that were in my sample are on the, these kind of combinations of medications working against each other.
You know, Tom Moore, who's done some of the great research on psychiatric drugs, including the study of violence based on looking at all the reports of the FDA and which drugs cause the most violence. Tom was recently on the show, and he called this process of giving psychiatric drugs putting a chemical ball in the china shop of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at just what dopamine does, dopamine is probably the main neurotransmitter system to the frontal lobes. So it's having a very strong regulatory effect on every activity we consider human, all the activities, love, hate, violence, thinking, judging, planning. I mean, if you can name what it is to be working as a human, dopamine plays a regulatory place in that. In addition, dopamine is affecting hormones. In addition, it's found in the cells in the body. This is a widespread neurotransmitter of huge, complex effects that we haven't the faintest idea about, mm-hmm. other than some gross things like blocking it deactivates the whole human being, and overstimulating it tends to make people crazy. That's the amphetamines,
mm-hmm.
like the stimulants, including methamphetamine and cocaine. So you're so right that putting the two together, one that's stimulating the dopamine, one that's blocking the dopamine, can do nothing but increase the outrageous bull in the china shop effect.
Yeah.
It's just making these kids unable to grow up, unable to know which end is up, unable to know their feelings. It's a miracle they can respond to psychotherapy under those conditions. And that they can is just a tribute to the strength of the human spirit.
Yeah. You know, that raises – so one paper that I ended up writing – again, as a result of my graduate work, and everyone had told me as a student that you could only effectively do psychotherapy with somebody diagnosed with schizophrenia if they were effectively medicated first. So you couldn't do good therapy unless they were effectively medicated. And as it turns out, so I started to look for this study years ago, and I'm like, well, everyone's telling me this, so it must be true. There must be a research project out there that demonstrated it, and I couldn't find a thing. And your colleague and, you know, Bert Caron, who's somebody I just idolize, you know, he's done such amazing work in exploring the psychotherapy of schizophrenia. So I was looking at all this different literature, and so one of the components that I started to zero in on is the chemical oxytocin, and it's just one piece of the bonding process. You know, of course, trust building and bonding and connecting with others is vastly complicated, well beyond our understanding. But oxytocin has been in the news a lot as one of these, you know, bonding chemicals. So I started to look at what these, what the psychiatric drugs do in relation to oxytocin. And there's very little research, virtually no research in humans. So I had to extrapolate most of this from animal studies. But all of the medications that are used in you know, whether it's the anticonvulsants, the antipsychotics, the antidepressants, stimulants have the opposite effect, but all of the other medications reduce the availability of oxytocin. So it actually creates a disadvantage in establishing a bonding relationship, which I found amazing. You know, you've already, like, when you're working with somebody that has really just been dealt a hand from hell, you know, they just have had a horrible life. They've been, you know, through abuse situations or just horrible life experiences. And then you want to establish a trusting relationship with them, but they're already on a handful of medications. You're working at a disadvantage, which is just another really frustrating piece of the system that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're making such good analyses here of the contradictions and the bizarreness that's going on in the field. It's really great to hear you talking about all this. I just want you to keep talking about your work, actually. I don't have a lot to add to that other than, yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah,
and
well,
the more you can write about it, the better.
Yeah, and some of these kids that were on these medications. Now, the other big issue around polypharmacy, the sample we have, the kids weren't just on one medication or two medications. Some of them were on that low. And actually, we had a handful of kids that were on no medications at all. There was one facility that their psychiatrist was very conservative, which is pretty uncharacteristic for residential treatment centers. But some of these kids were on like six medications. One child I remember, they're all teenagers, but one kid I remember was on Depakote, Abilify, Concerta, Wellbutrin, and Topamax. And three of those medications are directly targeting dopamine. So the Abilify goes in and messes with it, like the bull in the china shop that you mentioned. Then Concerta goes in, dramatically elevates it, and Wellbutrin goes in and dramatically elevates it too. So it's one of these combinations that it just staggers me. And like you said, it's amazing that these kids still get up and make it through the day. So this is, it's a topic that I really want to tackle, and I've been pulling some literature out and wanting to put a paper together, because I think it really is something that the field needs to address, because these combinations are increasingly common. And I think, you know, as well-intentioned as the prescribers may be in this, I think a lot of times they may be targeting the inattention a child presents with, and they'll throw the Concerta at them, and then but the child is also aggressive, so they'll add Risperdal to the thing, but they're a little depressed, so they'll add Wellbutrin to it, without thinking about the overlapping mechanisms of action or the competing mechanisms of action. So it's a practice that's going on far too frequently. So I want to just start to create a discussion about it and get some papers out there and see what happens. And we'll see. I mean, like I mentioned before, the kids that are placed in residential care are really some of the most troubled kids that are out there. They only represent a small fraction of kids that are in the mental health system. But that, you know, it speaks to another major concern, that we're living in a country that has over 20% of their kids meeting the diagnostic criteria for a mental illness. And then, you know, that equates to almost 15 million kids. So then with that come all the assumptions we have about mental illness, you know, and largely based on bad science, but that they're all chemical imbalances, there's something wrong with their brains, it's all genetic. But that applies to like 15 million kids out there, which is a pretty scary prospect, and leaves parents very frustrated, because then kids get involved in treatment that has a high likelihood of not working out well. You know, even our evidence-based programs, some of the best research out there shows that kids are, about 60% of kids are going to respond favorably to the treatments. And that's even in psychotherapy studies. You know, 30 to 40% of kids often don't respond to even the established evidence-based psychotherapy programs. So it leaves somebody feeling like, oh my gosh, my kid is too severe, or my kid can't be helped, when in fact it's a failing of our programs. And not at all to dismiss all the great work that's going on out there, but we have a long way to go before we're getting the results we really should be getting.
I have two thoughts about that. Well, first, I think the figure of 20% is much too low. You know, the estimate for boys, especially boys, the estimate for boys is 20% getting diagnosed as ADHD and being drugged at some point. And that's just for ADHD, and that's one of the better studies that we had. Many kids now are getting diagnosed for other things, and bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety, and they're getting OCD, I mean, everything,
yep.
Every adult diagnosis. And they're getting often the heavier drugs, not the stimulants, the heavier in the sense of the neuroleptics or antipsychotic drugs. So I think that the threat to children is even more monstrous, massive, and epidemic than that figure, which is of 20%, which in itself would be terrifying. I also am so glad about the work you're doing, which I'm really learning about on the show, about how much you're working on the polypharmacy area. You know, I've written so many books and articles, but I haven't addressed that with nearly the amount of scrutiny that it deserves. It would be a huge contribution for you to be writing more about this. And what a shame that nobody who actually prescribes is writing about it.
Right. You know, I do have a couple. So in my little circles of residential treatment, I have a couple psychiatrists I work with, and one in particular is really on the ball with this stuff. He is very concerned about the rates of medication we're using. But again, I think there's such a climate of just believing the expert. And I think this applies to psychology too. So when parents or other providers, you know, are interacting with people, like if a parent takes their child to a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist says, well, they need these three different medications, you know, they're put in a position of just like, well, they're the expert. And I think we as a society have put physicians in that role, which is very unfair, rather than just saying, well, what we have just probably isn't going to get good results, so we have to be creative. You know, everybody wants some hard science and a clear decision on what to do, but many times those aren't available. And like you mentioned, like the diagnostic categories like pediatric bipolar disorder and now the new one called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, they are just kind of catch-alls for kids that are angry and upset and out of control. And there's a bunch of those kids out there, but rather than asking them why they're feeling out of control and angry, we say, well, we can control these with powerful chemicals that in the long run is going to do long-standing damage to their brain. One of the other things, speaking about the research, the data I collected, one trend that I was seeing, because when I first started in the field, Haldol was one of the drugs of choice. You know, it was just being used everywhere. Then it kind of tapered off. But one of the things I started to see in the data set we have is that more kids were being placed on Haldol, which is stunning, I mean, in a shocking way, because there's an article that came out, I think it was 2013, that summarized 28 different studies that highlighted the neurotoxic effects of Haldol. And in fact, the title of the article is Haldol is Clearly Neurotoxic, Should It Be Banned? And it summarized.
I've never heard of that marvelous article.
Oh, I'll send it to you. It is.
You must.
Yeah, it's a good one. And it's in, I think the journal is called Current Psychiatry. So it's a, you know, mainstream psychiatric journal. And it, you know, that, but that was a few years ago. And here we sit with kids that are still on Haldol. So something we know does damage in the central nervous system, we're still using on a daily basis. It's just mind-blowing to me.
I see kids in my practice of all ages, well, starting usually not much younger than three or four, they come in with their moms. Sometimes they were not intended to be a part of the practice, but their parents bring them in for some help. And my experience is so clear, and I wonder what you think about my experience. It seems to me that we know exactly how to help children. The optimal way is by helping their parents.
Yep.
And helping the whole family. And if you're in a situation like the work you do, where some of the kids, their families are very, very toxic and won't cooperate or don't exist or in jail, then what the kid needs most of all is a new good family. And then for somebody to work with the new good family, either foster or preferably adoption. So to me, the whole issue is family life.
Yep.
And to drug a child because the parents are distressed, disturbed, or overwhelmed, or simply need to take a parenting class, mm-hmm. is one of the great atrocities of our culture.
Yeah, you know, and that speaks to another area of research that actually the last time you and I were in person together was at Michigan State University when you and Bert Caron put together that conference. And during that conference, you introduced me to Michael Corrigan, who was on on your show a few weeks ago. But he and I collaborated to create the Multidimensional Youth Assessment. And just highlighting the issue of family. So what this assessment, it's an outcomes monitoring tool, and it really provides an end-to-end solution. And part of the real magic of this, it's now being offered by Qualtrics, which is a huge data collection and analysis company based out of Utah. But when we were putting this together, the goal was to really create an opportunity for the youth to express themselves and identify what their needs are, for the parents and caregivers to express themselves and identify what their needs are, and then for the agency staff, whether it's foster care staff or residential treatment staff or hospital staff, whoever it is, to give their clinical assessment of what's going on. But then the results are all synthesized together to paint a picture, in a really full, robust picture of what the needs are for that child and family. And one of the things that we found in the research we did, in the research, the residential kids that we interviewed, you know, very much to your point, if they had a toxic family situation that they were coming from, the thing that they repeatedly mentioned over and over and over, they just wanted to get back to a safe, loving, supportive environment. And even if that was a foster care environment, only like three or four of the kids that I remember that we interviewed said they never wanted anything to do with their biological parents, but everybody else that had been removed from their family wanted some contact with their biological parents. Yeah. And knowing that just the horrible things that could have happened, whether it's drug use in the home or just parents that were ill-equipped to raise kids at that point or whatever the conditions were, something bad had gone on that ended up them not being able to care for their kids. But in the end, these kids want to go back and a chance to make it better again. So, that issue of connection and support and having a loving family environment is just so important for these kids. It's important for all of us. But, you know, when these kids are in trouble, that, like you said, rather than just throwing all these treatments at them, part of what we have to emphasize is creating that healthy environment, healthy, supportive environment for them.
Bob, I'd travel all the way to Chicago for you to be my therapist if I needed one. How do people get in touch with you?
You know what? I'll give you my email address, which I'll give you my school email address because I'm checking that thing all the time. It's rfoltz, which is F-O-L-T-Z, at thechicagoschool.edu. Or my private practice phone is 847-518-9546.
Bob, get in touch with me anytime you've got a new research project or anything else you want to talk to. It's a pleasure to stay in touch with you. Thanks for being on the Peter Bregan Hour.
You're welcome.